You don't have much of a body. No pecs, no abs, no biceps.
I have a great ass, and I'm blonde. You have no idea how far that gets me.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week, we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called It's Because I'm Gay, Right? It's number 13 in season 2 of Queer as Folk.
It first aired in the U.S. on April 14th, 2002.
It was directed by John Grayson, who did 4 episodes. Previously, he directed season 2's All Better Now, and from season 1, he directed Move It or Lose It and Daddy Dearest, Sonny Boy. This is his last Queer as Folk episode.
It's Because I'm Gay, Right? It was written by executive producers Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, and the teleplay was written by Ephraim Seeger. This is his 3rd of 8 episodes as a writer, and he also produced 34 episodes of Queer as Folk. Of course, let's not forget that he also wrote 6 episodes and produced 19 episodes of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, in which you are still entitled to your wrong opinion. That show is great.
And I still have not done the Carlton for you yet.
I am just waiting very patiently, listeners.
Here's a synopsis of this episode from Queer as Folk, the book. This is a book published by Showtime and Pocket Books back in 2003, and it was written by Paul Roditis. It's a decent fan book, but it's a little too fanboy in many places, so here's how they describe this episode.
Ted and Michael managed to get the famous drag queen Davina DeVore to perform at the Angel Ball because she used to date Debbie back in high school, back when she was a he named Danny.
After seeing a photo of Danny, Michael realizes that his mom has been lying to him about his father and that his real dad is the drag queen.
Melanie and Lindsay try to get Gus into the best preschool and mistakenly think they have problems because of their being same-sex parents.
Justin's dad announces that he is not paying for school anymore, forcing Justin to get a job dancing at Babylon.
That's less of a synopsis and more of a recap, because that's literally everything that happens in this episode.
Yes, which will set the stage nicely for our conversation about it.
Yes.
This episode was really only about 3 of the main characters, Debbie, Michael, and Justin. The lesbians are once again relegated to a minor story that never surfaces again. Ted and Emmett are barely in the episode and really don't have anything meaningful to add. Usually I like stories that go deep with a couple characters versus the franticness of season 1 where everyone had to have their moments in an episode. But this episode really disappointed me.
Really?
It did.
Okay, well, let's start breaking it down with our A story.
This drag show that opens things up. What kind of a show was that? This was in a lounge and it had like the little lamps on every table. What was that place?
It was almost less a drag show and more a cabaret because Davina is doing live singing rather than lip syncing, which those more classic queens, they usually stick to the lip sync. And I feel like live singing is a more of a current drag thing. So to see someone who you would say is probably the more traditional drag queen doing live singing, it treated it more like it was a cabaret act than a drag show.
Yeah, she was doing all the work herself. I just thought it was a strange venue.
Definitely not, you know, doing the typical drag shows that we see in Boys Town where they're doing it in bar and or restaurant that is serving brunch right at the same time.
Possibly designer martinis.
Yes.
Emmett had a funny line here where he said,
if you ask me, nobody makes a better woman than a gay man.
I love that line for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know if it's politically correct or not, but I loved it.
Well, I'm sure there are many women who would disagree with that. But I get the sentiment in terms of the performance. I feel drag is all about the celebration of a woman. It's never about mocking because I feel drag queens love women and they bring that out in their art. I think the best drag queens do that.
How did Michael, Ted, and Emmett get backstage at this event anyway? I mean, they had like a stage manager and everything, a headset on. They just were backstage all of a sudden.
I had many questions about the security at this event because Yes, they're already watching from backstage. We don't see them in the audience, and then somehow they got in like the inn.
They didn't stage door her.
No, they were just backstage,
right,
watching her.
They got back there somehow.
And the stage manager is just letting them be there, possibly in the way. And when Davina gets off stage and she, you know, snips a little at the stage manager, and the stage manager says something like, "Yes, ma'am," or "Sir," and like gets all kind of befuddled because she can't tell gender, apparently.
Yeah, that was a little cliche. Stage manager of that venue should have known how to address the talent.
Right. Usually in drag, I would say female pronouns are more prevalent.
Right.
So I don't think it would have been out of the realm that the stage manager has probably worked a drag show in her life and could have easily have gotten that correct.
Some queens get really upset if you say he when they are in drag.
Well, yeah, because it could be quite the read of a drag queen. You're telling her she's looking butch.
I think it's more innocent than that, though.
Well, sometimes. Sometimes it can be very malicious. But we're in a point now in drag today where it's less about saying, "I'm going to sell you the illusion of a woman." And it's more about just fucking with the gender. And I think that's super cool. You see queens like Sasha Velour, who's the most recent winner of Drag Race, is more about just blurring the line of gender. And you see a queen like a current contestant on season 10, Cameron Michaels, who out of drag is super ripped and has started to use the muscle body to her advantage in the show, which I think is super cool. So I like that drag has made this evolution from we're just selling you a female illusion to we're just gonna say screw it to gender altogether.
Something new in character development was that Ted, Emmett, Michael, and Vic Volunteer.
I was like, where did this come from? I was really surprised to know that this was, they're asking Davina to perform at a benefit. I love that, you know, like this is the organization we work for, and this is what it's done for people, and we think it would be really great if you could perform for our benefit. My question comes down to, doesn't she have some sort of representation, or is she just asking these gigs?
Yeah.
Normally you go through an agent, some sort of booking agent to get the talent. So I'm a little surprised to know that they could just go backstage like, "Could you perform for our little group?"
Yeah, they broke into the backstage and then they have to go volunteer.
Right.
Which was really a setup for Vic to hear that they were pursuing Davina DeVore in order to perform at this ball that I guess Ted's somehow involved in. I'm not sure how Ted got involved here, though. Is this part of him co-chairing an important event with the A-gays?
Maybe. I don't know.
If now,
maybe in his newfound wealth, he's decided to explore philanthropic opportunities. But yeah, so they feel that with Davina DeVore, who I guess is sort of a hometown hero in the Pittsburgh gay community, this was a great opportunity for them to get a big audience for their benefit. I do want to just say that Davina DeVore, for those who don't know, is played by Gary Beach. Gary Beach is and this is where I'm going to go on my large tangent.
I'll lean back with a glass of wine real quick.
Gary Beach is a Broadway veteran of over 40 years, having premiered in everything from 1776 to The Producers, which won him his Tony Award for Best Featured Actor for playing Roger Debris. He's also the original Lumiere in the Broadway production of Beauty and the Beast, and most recently was in the first revival of La Cage aux Folles, where he played Alban, and one of the many revivals of Les Mis, where he played Monsieur Thénardier. So with his roles in The Producers and La Cage aux Folles, there has definitely been a drag history with Gary Beach. So I think it's very interesting that he was doing The Producers around the same time that this episode aired. So I started to kind of see the influences of his characters kind of melding when I discovered that it was Gary Beach. And I thought, oh, that's amazing.
I remember over the weekend, I had messaged you when I was watching the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Do you know who plays Davina DeVore?" And you said, "Oh, I've got this." I'm like, okay. Good.
This was my moment to shine.
This is your wheelhouse.
Absolutely. So if you wanted to see more of Gary Beach, I am sure he will be in a Broadway show very, very soon. Or you could also check out the movie version of the Producers, which came out in 2005, where he reprised his role as Roger Debris.
Vic's ears totally perked up when he heard the name.
You know her?
Honey, I knew her when she was a him. He was Danny DeVore then. We went to high school together.
No.
You know, maybe if you use the personal connection, you could convince her to change her mind. Me? You're our only hope.
I thought you didn't even want her.
Well, that was before I found out that she's a friend of the family.
I'm sure she wouldn't remember me.
He seemed to know something here. And what coincidence, they went to high school together. Go figure.
What a coinkadink.
Yeah.
And this was after that moment where Davina has initially said no to doing the benefit because she does so many of them, which I get. There's that whole idea of like, oh, could you donate your time? Donate your time. She probably does it a lot. Drag queens got to make that rent money too. But I find it really interesting to watch how quickly these characters can turn on a dime when they get dismissed by someone they've like really looked up to, like the way Ted reacted when those AGs sort of blew him off at first. And he's like, I want nothing to do with them. They're awful hypocritical people. And then they like show a little bit of interest and all of a sudden he just comes right back and like, oh, they're just great. The same thing happens here. At first he's like, I want nothing to do with her. And then next thing you know, he's like, well, Michael, do you think you could get her? It's like, yeah. Who were you not 2 minutes ago, Ted?
I did like how as soon as the name came up, Vic heard it, then he kind of reacted to it, and then he's like, oh, this could go down a path that we're not prepared to go down yet. So I liked all these moments where Vic was kind of the foreboding emotional oboe of the scenes.
It was like he divulged just a little too much.
Yeah.
As soon as he said, I remember when she was a he, which, side note, I don't think there's anything in terms of how Davina identifies. Like, I understand they're probably trying to make a commentary about, well, there's Davina, the drag queen, and then there's Danny, the guy that plays her. But I don't think there's any type of actual transitional gender happening here.
I did like that photo shoot of Davina in the hotel room when Michael showed up. She had a 5-star hotel suite.
It was a suite.
Not bad for that drag queen.
As a photographer, Patrick, I do want to talk to you about those angles in which they were shooting and the anonymous photographer who was encouraging her.
There used to be the saying that everybody has one good angle. And then MySpace came around where all the emo boys were taking extreme angled shots of themselves. So I think in the world of portraiture and editorial, you can shoot from any angle. And shooting looking down on somebody is generally pretty flattering. Not that high, though. This guy was up on a stepladder. He was that high.
And Davina was just like looking up and full, I'm going to say it, Betty Davis drag, because the foundation was too pale. The eyebrows were wherever the fuck they wanted to be. I had questions about who was the makeup artist, if Davina's doing it herself or she's hired someone, because that person needs to get fired.
I didn't think that she was an especially well-made up queen.
No.
She was looking a little crusty.
Yeah. As if the phrase dated just kind of got slapped in her face.
Yeah. There was a really nice quick zoom shot that Grayson used. As soon as Vic's name is mentioned, you hear that.
Oh, really? And who was that?
Vic Grassi.
Vic Grassi. Oh, my God. I remember Vic.
Yeah. Where it's sort of like the lights get bright on it, too, as they zoom in really quickly.
That was the moment where we started to realize, okay, there's something going on in this story. Mm-hmm. This should get interesting. Davina sums it up pretty well.
So, if Vic is your uncle, then Debbie must be your mother.
You knew my mom?
Knew her? I dated her.
I dated her.
Yeah. I just loved how chivalrous that sounded. It's like very noble.
I would like to think that when he heard Vic's name, that maybe Danny and Vic had a torrid affair right before he left.
That's another storyline that we can follow up in Vic Grassi, the high school years, the prequel that we talked about a few episodes ago. Debbie's reaction to hearing Danny DeVore's name was priceless in the diner. She pretty quickly fell to pieces.
Danny DeVore.
Better known as Davina DeVore. Mm.
Michael got her to agree to perform at the Angel Ball.
Yeah, thanks to you.
What did I have to do with it?
Oh, she said she couldn't possibly turn down the son of her former flame.
You shut your mouth. He had no right to talk to my kid about my personal life.
Well, he didn't say anything. He just said that you two used to go out.
Yeah, it was like a million years ago. I wouldn't know him if I fell over him.
I like that, but we don't know why she's falling to pieces. So there wasn't enough buildup here for her to really have a reaction. We're just dropped into the storyline. We didn't have any prequel to it or anything really introducing it to us other than this episode. And in fact, after this, it all goes away.
Yeah, we've always known Debbie just to be a single mom. That's about it. And that his dad is dead. Like that, we don't really know much else. And then here we get everything. There wasn't any type of mention of the stories that we get in this episode, in the previous 30 episodes that we've seen.
It just came out of nowhere. So that was one of the reasons why I was a little disappointed in this episode. All of this that we've seen so far is enough to send Michael and Ben to Debbie's house to rummage through her hope chest. That seemed a little unusual to me. Like they heard a few things, so they're going to go break into Debbie's house and just rummage around and look for clues. So I didn't quite get
that. I didn't know if they were just like, let's go down memory lane and see what we find. Or if they were doing like real investigative journalism kind of search.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I have my parents' yearbooks from high school. They kept them, and after both my parents had passed away, I was cleaning the house and I found the yearbooks and I did keep them and I did look through them, but that was just more nostalgia. I wasn't on a detective case.
Yeah, you weren't on a hunt for anything.
Right, exactly.
The mystery.
Debbie had a great profile in the yearbook, though. We find out her full name for the first time, which is Deborah Jane Grassy. So I wrote down the things that were next to her picture, and these were abbreviations, and I got some of them. There's one I didn't get. So it said AMB, which I took for ambition, and the answer was celebrate New Year's in every time zone. And then there's one PD. I didn't know what PD stood for, though. Do you have any ideas? She wrote celebrate every New Year's right here in the pit, Pittsburgh.
Do you think the P stands for Pittsburgh?
No, because then the next one was PP, which I took as pet peeve, and that she works. Listed dishonest people. The next one was PS, which I thought was personal saying, and she replied, shit, all my sayings have swears in them. That sounds like Debbie.
They wouldn't print shit in a yearbook.
Well, so it was start out. It was start out.
Oh, okay.
It was S star 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 T.
That's good.
And then ACT, which I took for activities. Mm-hmm. Debbie participated in yearbook. SC rep, which I'm saying student council rep, maybe. Yeah. Spirit club. And parties, parties, parties. So Debbie was kind of a wild child in high school. She almost seems exactly what she is now back in high school.
Some people don't change.
I thought this was just a great prop moment. Again, we talked about property supervisor Tanya Lemke a couple episodes ago, where I had picked out the AIDA ad in the newspaper.
Yes.
That Emmett and George went to. So this was nice work. Somebody, probably Tanya, went to all the work to produce this page in the yearbook that was only on screen for about 10 frames or so.
But it was almost like an Easter egg.
Yeah, it was nice. I liked it. Danny DeVore's profile clearly had a picture of Michael in it.
I was like, that's real on the nose.
Yeah, that's like circa 2002, like Photoshopping pre-Snapchat filters. Of course, Ben thinks that he's cute. I did notice that Danny DeVore, because Danny had his own profile, and his said something that he wanted to become a Broadway star, but he and Debbie were also in Spirit Club together.
They've got spirit. Yes, they do.
This is interesting and all, but why are they looking him up? There's just a hint of more than just curiosity here. And Michael is interrogating Vic about it. His curiousness was curious. It didn't take much for him to really dig into this, which I thought was weird. I don't know why he was doing this. And that's where I thought the script was a little bit weak. He had a hunch.
I had the same note about that. I felt it was just very easy for him to be looking at the picture of Danny and the yearbook and be like, that's me. Wait a minute. Is he my dad?
Right. Ta-da.
I felt like that was just a big jump for him to make. Though, it should probably have been something where it's like, oh, that's a curiosity. He looks a little like me.
Yeah, well, Ben points it out. It's like, oh, he's hot. It's like, I was like, oh, Ben, this is falling together like way too easily. There's no obstruction going on here. It's just falling.
There was no
buildup.
It went from, that looks like me. Are you my dad?
Yeah.
I was like, there's 0 to 60 here.
I am your father. Debbie was deflecting everything with humor. She had a really funny line here.
Tell me that's not my chin.
Not even close. And trust me, I know chins. I have several of them.
I thought that was great comedy.
I thought that was brilliant.
So the truth comes out. And the whole time I'm thinking, all right, so 30 years ago, Debbie committed an identity theft in order to give Michael a fictional father complete with a stolen Valor Purple Heart.
So he's just a war hero.
Just? They awarded him the Purple Heart. He was on a rescue mission, carving his way through the jungle when a landmine exploded.
You said it was a Jeep accident.
He was carving his way in a Jeep when it ran over a landmine.
You can't even keep the goddamn story straight.
Stop confusing me.
Look, it was a long time ago. It doesn't matter now.
I just want to know the truth.
I do have questions about where the hell she got this Purple Heart, if it's like a real Purple Heart. But is it really identity theft? Did she just sort of took the last name of the person? Because people change their names all the time.
Well, yeah, I thought about that. So I'm thinking, where did the soldier's death benefits go?
Where? Oh, I didn't think it was that elaborate. I mean, I will say I thought it was elaborate to say, okay, I'm going to say it's this person. Because she just said that I took his name from the newspaper.
And changed her name and everything? I mean, that's crazy.
That's why I said it's pretty elaborate. But I don't think it was so much to where she was committing fraud.
Okay.
I think she saw the name and said, great, that's what I'll do.
It's a bit psycho, if you ask me.
It's, yeah, I won't say it's psycho, but it's definitely
severe troubling. Personality disorder.
She had a very clear purpose for doing it.
Yeah,
in her mind, she justified it in the way of how could I, you know, in the 70s, just out of high school, mom, try to explain to my son that his father is a gay drag queen performer, you know. So yeah, she wanted to give him something to look up to, which then, you know, there's the whole breakdown of trying to understand the gender dynamics of that, you know, giving him this masculine hero that's a total fake.
It took Michael 30 years to figure all this out, though. You'd think that at some point along the line he would know something about it. Grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins. How do you explain that away for 30 years?
The fact that those were questions that just decided to come up with him after all this. Who are my grandparents? They're dead. Yeah. Aunts, uncles. There weren't any. I was like, this conversation never happened before.
Right, right. Yeah. It's like the first thing that kids ask is, where did I come from? It's like mommy and daddy wanted to, I don't know. And
mommy
so
and daddy had
too
much box Chardonnay. And but yeah, it was, I mean, this is one hell of an elaborate lie that she's concocted.
And it's starting to fall apart because up until this point, there's only ever been one picture of the guy on the mantle.
Literally one.
Yeah.
It makes no sense.
And
in this moment, just because as I'm going along with this storyline, it's where I start to feel for Michael. Granted, he should have posited some of these questions earlier in his life. I would think maybe like when you're a teenager, you would be like, wait a minute. Some of this just doesn't add up. I would like to think Michael has some intelligence, but to know that everything you sort of known is a lie.
Yeah.
That's been perpetrated for 30 years.
Well, and plus Vic was complicit in this too.
Absolutely.
And he got off scot-free because he's been lying the whole time as well. So that was just a big plot hole too, is Michael gets livid at Debbie, but Vic is just like not even a part of the equation. And granted, it's like one thing with mother and son, but by all accounts, Vic has been part of Michael's life almost since day one. So why wasn't this an easy thing for Vic to instill into Debbie? Like, hey, it's okay that the gay future drag queen sired your son.
It's the same concept when Michael started dating Ben and she had such an aversion to Ben being HIV positive when she's had a brother who survived that, hey, it's okay.
It's right.
Like, it's not as big a deal as you're making it.
It's a plausible impossibility again. So Debbie and Danny finally meet up. Danny figures it out all on his own.
Just like Michael did.
Michael is a very nice young man.
I'm very proud of him.
And I would be too. He's polite, caring, good looking, In fact, he reminded me a lot of someone I used to know. Only at first, I couldn't figure out who it was. And then when I discovered that you were his mother, I realized. I was looking at myself. In a mirror. Through time. Why didn't you ever tell me?
Debbie's explanation was always that she wanted Michael to have a hero father. And because Danny lied to Debbie about being gay.
I thought that was like a little mention of, what did you expect me to do? I asked you to come back and marry me. There was like this lilt in her voice that was just like, I knew that we could never be together and it would be unfair of me to ask this of you.
Yeah, but it's like, oh, you lied to me about being gay. Therefore, I'm going to invent an elaborate story of a Vietnam veteran stranger who was killed, and this is going to be Michael's father, and I'm going to change my name and Michael's name, and Vic is going to keep quiet about it for 30 years. There's no grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins.
Now, that notwithstanding, I will say that she kind of gave him a get out of jail free card.
Who? Michael?
No, Danny. She allowed him to, I'm not going to entrap you in this life that is clearly not yours. You go off and be the star that you're supposed to be.
Seems like he could have done that, though, without the get out of jail free card. Because Debbie, being strong woman, doesn't need a man in her life to raise her son, especially her gay son with her gay brother. So I don't know. This story was just ludicrous.
I'm not going to say it's full of, you know, it's not full of plot holes.
I like that.
I'm trying to plug some of them up. I'm not getting there, though.
I did like that Danny was content just leaving things be and make an attempt to just kind of bat Michael's assertions away. Like right in the middle of this entire moment, as Michael is finding out, there's this incredible blocking move where Davina slipped into the changing room and came back out dressed as a kindly older gay man that vaguely resembled my therapist.
That's
with the cardigan.
It was a real Superman move. Because yeah. I'm sorry, no drag queen can go from full drag to street clothes within a matter of seconds. You don't get to take one wet nap to your face and you're out of drag. It made no sense. Like, even his hair was done. I was like, no, it would be matted and sweaty if he was working for it. Because we saw him, his performance, he was like up in the rafters doing that angel song. And
oh, yeah.
And with that terrible wig, his wigs. Who the hell styled these damn wigs? I was angry for Davina. How dare they?
I think this was like well before drag went mainstream on TV. I think back then it was more camp than anything
RuPaul
else.
RuPaul was around for quite a while.
Well, so that's true.
And plus, Tu Wong Fu was in only in 95. So they had at least 6 years to get their shit together.
But I...
But
I don't know.
Yeah, it's because clearly Debbie has done I personally think a great job of raising Michael on her own. You know, he's living, he's being who he is. She's done a good job. And I like that they're like, let's not complicate this any more than we need to.
Yeah. You know, maybe since she has done a great job and Michael has turned 30 recently, wouldn't it have been a more interesting story if she decided to tell him and there was a buildup to him telling, not this, like, I found out because I rummaged through your hope chest and found your yearbook. It just seemed very sitcom-y. And I think some of the stories in the past you've called functional. The script really only serves the function of getting you from point A to point B. And the overall arc is great, but the path there is just way too easy and slippery.
This particular storyline is one that we just see that play out in this episode. Like, there's no overlying reason to know who Michael's father is, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we always knew that he had no father, which is why he read comic books. He knew that his dad was a war hero.
Right.
But there was never like the Brian Kinney level of like father problems or anything like that. So all of a sudden Michael needs to have a drag queen father. Maybe this could have been a good storyline if they went further with it.
Is this continued on for some reason?
No, it's not.
then I would have understood why it was in here, but it's sort of just,
I think the most we ever hear of this again is when Michael is raging about something one day and he says, I'm half Italian and half drag queen. And that's it. I don't think we ever hear.
Okay.
about this again. So again, this story came out of nowhere and for no reason. And I just thought that this was an opportunity to really inject a whole new recurring story into the show. But it was just really simplistic. I just didn't like that.
Michael, may I tell you the one truth I've learned in all my years? The truth is what you choose to believe. When I'm on stage, people believe I'm Davina DeVoe. Not because I'm a great female impersonator, but because they want to.
What does that have to do with whether you're my father or if my mother lied to me?
Your mother gave you something to believe in. A hero. A father you could be proud of. Because she loves you. That's the truth. Whether you choose to believe it or not is up to you.
The final scene of the story between Michael and Debbie was pretty well written, though. Even if the rest of the story was just utter shite.
Tell us how you really feel.
I mean, Michael shows up at Debbie's house at 3 a.m. because he went there after bars closed.
Oh, right.
With the yearbook. So he's been carrying this yearbook around.
Carried it into Babylon, I think.
Yeah. So he finds Debbie putting away the lie. She's taking down the picture and kind of dusting it off and closes the lid on the Purple Heart and hides it. And
she's going to pawn it if it's a real thing.
Well, then they agree to just more or less maintain the story because it doesn't really matter to their relationship. And I'm like, why though? Because for anybody, discovering your biological father would have much bigger consequences on you. Even if you choose not to meet the person or make them a part of your life, that's still a thing. But here, Michael didn't seem to have that problem. It was all about his relationship with Debbie, and the fact that he discovered his biological father was just a blink of the eye gone. So this is why I started to think that this was the episode where the series jumped the shark.
You know, I totally thought that you thought jumping the shark was the wedding episode because it was just so outlandish, and we both had very similar strong negative reactions to it. So I find it interesting. I was a little surprised to know that this was the episode where you felt that it jumped the shark, because the way they handle this drag father storyline was a little clumsy for sure.
Yeah.
But like, I understood like where the rest of the episode went. So I was a little surprised to know that this was the episode.
I just didn't think there was enough meat behind Debbie committing a 30-year felony and fraud. And
again, I don't think there was really fraud.
Psychotic
involved.
Behavior. She needs to go into therapy over how she behaved here. You can't get away with something so patently untrue that you're selling to your son for 30 years. I just thought this was one of the weakest storylines in the entire series. It just didn't need to be here. It didn't serve much of a purpose in furthering the lives of these characters. So jump the shark, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to go jump the shark and be back in a minute to talk about Justin becoming a go-go boy. Still Queer as Folk, there's more on the way. If you like our show, please give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. So apparently Justin's career at the Pittsburgh Institute of Fine Art has led him to his first show, which is at the diner.
He is a local artist.
And then guess who walks into the diner? Our favorite?
Sherry Miller!
Yay!
Justin, you didn't tell me you had your very own show.
Hey guys. It's not exactly the Museum of Modern Art.
Jennifer Taylor, yes. So she's there really to break the news that out of nowhere, Craig Taylor announces that he's going to stop paying Justin's art school tuition.
Because he's a bitch.
And I liked how Jennifer Taylor talked about, I'll cash in my IRA. It's like, honey, you take such a penalty when you do that at your age. It's like, you can't do that.
Right. I was like, she even mentioned that she had talked to her accountant. I feel like he would have warned you about the tax implications about cashing that kind of thing in.
And Justin, of course, is worried that his mother and his mostly invisible little sister are going to go hungry and be on the streets. So he nobly says that he will take care of his tuition himself.
Which I will say, while I found Justin being prideful in this moment, I also appreciated that he felt he needed to be able to make it on his own. He wanted to show that he's being an adult. He's like, I will find another job that pays more. I will be able to handle it. And I liked that. I was like, good for you, Justin. You are showing a certain maturity at your age.
And I thought it showed a certain naivete about how much money he'll actually need.
That too. But I appreciated the sentiment.
Because the Pittsburgh Institute of Fine Art has got to cost $20,000 a year.
Oh, private institutions like that?
Yeah.
Jeez.
So where's he going to come up with that? I know. Brian will set him straight.
I told you that I can pay for it myself.
With your secret Swiss bank account?
I'll get another job. A real job, one that actually pays.
Making $300 to $400 a week.
So I will apply for a scholarship or a loan.
What are you going to use for collateral, your ass?
There was an unfortunate line here in the script that I didn't like at all. And that was where Brian reminds him that he saved his life.
I practically owe you my fucking life.
What do you mean practically?
I didn't like that at all. And I thought that we got way past that after Justin had moved out that one time when Brian said, yes, you moved in because you got bashed and I felt sorry for you. So
right. Does it have that kind of ammunition still? It's a little bit tired to keep using that.
It was just very off key mm-hmm. in that particular moment. The only thing that livened this scene up was Brian getting roadhead.
Oh, and I mean, that camera like stayed with it for a while.
Yeah.
It kept going down there. I also really enjoyed the man that was standing idle in the car next to Brian. At first he had this sort of disgusted look, and then they cut back to him again. And he kind of had a smirk. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, he's into it. Okay.
I'm in the gayborhood.
Hey, I'm watching two homosexuals have public sex.
Something new at Babylon that we found out is the Go-Go Boys accept tips.
Not until this episode, because in no way in all the times we have gone to Babylon have I seen money gone into anyone's G-strings this entire time.
I did like that Justin was giving away money, though.
His last dollar. I like they made a point, because I had the same thought. I was like, wait a minute. Haven't we just had this discussion about how you need to be watching your money? And then I like that Brian says that, and he says, what does it matter? It's my last one anyway. And I was like, oh, okay. Thank you for acknowledging that.
Have you ever been to the Lucky Horseshoe in Chicago?
Once.
Only once? Did I take you there?
No, I went once during market days, and it was the last day of market days. So it was midnight on a Sunday. It was like the sad crowd.
Oh, yeah. The people that weren't quite ready to call it a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I actually find that place pretty fascinating. The transactional nature of it, is interesting. And so this scene where the dancer kind of squats down and Justin's tucking money into his underwear reminded me a lot of the Lucky Horseshoe, which is a gentleman's club in Chicago.
Yes.
Three stages with dancers. And I think I've said before, this is the first place that I actually enjoyed wine out of a hose. They have a hose dispenser, like a soda gun that used to shoot wine out of it.
Oh.
Now it comes out of a bottle.
Oh.
It's much more upscale now.
Yes. Sure.
So Justin decides, hey, I'm going to be a go-go boy. Let me talk to the owner of the bar. And then Justin gets shut down by the owner of the bar.
You don't have much of a body. No pecs, no abs, no biceps.
When you look at the previous episodes and you look at the dancers they have, these are all those more traditionally buffed out, very clearly defined body types.
Justin as a go-go boy at Babylon is definitely a little miscast, but okay, fair enough. And he gets shut down, he walks away, and then in the same shot, he comes back walking on the bar with no clothes on. Well, he had his underwear on.
Those Calvin Klein. No, Levi's. They were Levi's.
He managed to rip all of his clothes off and jump up onto the bar that quickly and just sort of sashay down the bar. And so...
But those Levi's, they look like you can tell he's been walking in them all day.
They were off-white or they got mixed in with a load of colored clothes.
And it was the fact that the fabric just looked like, hi, I've been wearing these all day.
Had some pilling.
Yes, they weren't, for someone who is about to claim that he has a great ass, which we know he does, it just didn't fit right to him.
Something I did notice here is, and I'm sure it was just like sock lines, but it looked like Justin has a series of scars on his calves. Do you think he's a cutter?
I did not. I've watched this episode twice and did not notice that.
It's funny. The reason that I happened upon this was because I was streaming it. I had the DVD at home and I streamed it and I was watching it remotely and it froze up right when he was on the bar with his calf in the shot.
Oh.
And so I noticed all these like slice marks on it. I'm sure they were just sock lines, but it got me thinking maybe Justin has some damage. Maybe he's a cutter. He's been inflicting pain on himself, harming himself. I just thought that was a little bit of a gaffe because the makeup people and the customers should notice that. It had a nice smooth twink leg.
Well, and I love that this is the first time we see the owner of Babylon.
We only see him one more time after this.
And I brought this up to you earlier because I was watching it again. I was trying to figure out who he reminded me of. And he reminded me of how Mike Myers looks like in that movie 54, where he plays the owner of Studio 54. And honestly, he was playing him just as skeezy because... because of what the owner asks of Justin.
Yeah, his audition was suitably slutty. Brian liked it too. There was this great cut that Grayson used where Justin's on the bar at Babylon and then without even skipping a beat, the same song still playing, all of a sudden he's on the table in Brian's loft. So I like that.
Yes, I was like, oh, that's clever.
As long as he didn't step on Brian's wontons.
Try not to step my wonton.
Yeah, because wontons can be fucking expensive, so...
I did like this cute little moment where he kind of falls off the table into Brian's lap, and Brian starts spanking him. He pulls his pants down and starts spanking Justin.
And then, of course, the lesbians walk right into the scene.
Oh, yeah, no knocking. They didn't get buzzed in. They just, like, open the door.
In which Brian says, no to himself, remember to lock the fucking door. I'm like, oh, now you want to lock the door. Everyone has walked in and out of that loft for the past season and a half, and now you're worried about locking the door?
There's a quick little moment that we'll talk to you when we get to the runner in this episode where all of a sudden Justin is fully clothed. So
again, another Superman move.
Yeah, he left camera for just a few instants, maybe a couple lines from the lesbians. He comes back, he has... pants, shirt, socks, everything on. So I kept thinking something got cut out of this scene that might have had Justin getting ready or getting dressed or something like that. I liked it, though. Apparently, on Justin's first shift, he's dressed as an angel.
For the benefit.
In rather large, awkward-looking trunks. Didn't like those. I liked his nasty, dirty little Levi's briefs better than these... big billowy trunks. It's too much material
strange,
on them.
Yeah.
Maybe it was just part of his angel costume.
I think so.
There's more than one gay bar in Chicago that has had similar corporate ladder climbing rules for their talent and workers. So I found this like pretty relatable. I know people that have come up in the hospitality industry in Chicago at some of the more downmarket establishments, unlike the ones that we go to.
Oh.
I was just talking about the Lucky Horseshoe, though, so I'm not sure where that one fits.
Well, so after the benefit and Babylon is closing down, Justin is asking for an opportunity to dance in the bar. And Gary, the owner, says maybe in 6 months, you got to work your way up. Which, so at first, he's saying, put in your time. I'm not going to give you...
Yeah, get your practice in.
Yeah, you've worked literally one night, and I'm not going to give you a prime spot the next night. And... Justin drops just enough of a hint of desperation that Gary capitalizes on it.
It was a nice scene when Justin came home and Brian is still up working. This has got to be like 3 or 4 in the morning, right?
Right. Well, let's discuss what Justin had been doing.
He blew him.
Right. At first, Justin...
Oh, no. He didn't blow him. Gary blew Justin.
Right.
Yeah.
And at first, because Justin could tell...
That's worth it.
Well, Justin could tell what Gary wanted. And at first he said, no, thanks. And then Gary capitalized on the power dynamic here and said, that's fine. Let me know when you're ready to make X amount of money.
I think it would have been more powerful if Justin blew him. That seems like it's more of a moment for Justin where all he had to do here is lean back and close his eyes and think of England.
Well, that still doesn't make it pleasurable.
Sure, but I don't know. Which would you rather do in order to get your spot on the bar dancing? Would you rather blow or get blown?
Well, I would want to do neither with someone that I have no attraction to.
Which one is the worst of two evils?
Well, and that's the thing. Like, this is exactly what the Me Too movement's all about right now, is about this exact kind of power dynamic that's happening and abuse of that. That's the whole commentary that we're having. So it's really interesting to see this scene. I'm sure back in 2002, people were just thinking like, ooh, that's so lurid and kind of hot. But you see it through today's eyes and you can't help but be like, this guy is using his power in a way to abuse Justin, because Justin said no and then only acquiesced because Gary is capitalizing on that desperation that Justin is feeling to make the money for school now.
Yeah, I just think that it would have been a much harder journey for him to actually do the blowing. I think dramatically it would have come across better as Justin making this gigantic prostitutorial move in order to secure his spot on the bar.
I guess I don't see too much of a delineation between either act.
So one seems a little more, what's the word I'm looking for? A little more salacious. Not salacious, devious.
So in that instance, dirty. I would find what transpired in the episode with Gary blowing Justin as more devious.
Yeah.
I personally would have found it. So or at least that's how I read the scene. But as you said, Justin comes home. The way I feel Brian greets Justin makes me feel like Brian is savvy to what happened.
Oh, yeah. Of course he knew what dancing on the bar meant.
Absolutely.
He rolled with it, though. He didn't care.
Because he said after one night.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like he knew.
Yeah, and I like that because it wasn't laid on with a trowel. It was just Brian going,
yeah.
I know what's going on here. I'm okay with that. Mm. We'll be right back to talk about Melanie, Lindsay, and Gus.
And while we're waiting for those poppers to kick in, make sure you go rate us on iTunes. Wow.
On demand and on the go. No downloading, no syncing, no wasted money. Stitcher, stream your favorite podcasts. Don't have Stitcher? Download it today for free at Stitcher.com or in the App Store. Still, queer as folk. So Gus is ready for preschool already. It seems like he was just born and circumcised.
Because he was. This is the thing I don't understand.
This would make him like four.
No. Well, that's the thing. They are planning so far ahead for Gus. Because, yeah, he has an age to where he's in preschool.
Right.
They're planning for something that's 2, 3, 4 years in the future. And I don't understand this obsession, because I feel like this is something we see in a lot of media as well as in the real world today. This obsession with making sure that your child gets the best education from the very beginning. So they're obsessing over making sure he gets the best preschool.
That part of the story didn't really surprise me. What did surprise me is that Gus is not actually in this episode.
Oh, right. Because the school is not for Gus. It's about showing face with the parents.
Yeah. So no Gus. Well, suddenly Melanie and Lindsay feel like they are a quota in the preschool racket.
But they sort of wanted to use that to their advantage at first, because Mel brings it up in that first interview saying, well, what about same-sex parents? And the school is saying like, oh, absolutely. That is something we want to recognize and make sure that we are including. So they feel good about it until they're rejected.
Yeah, I thought that they seemed to be making like too much of a deal over it, especially Melanie. I would have thought that she would never stoop to that type of thing.
To like, I'm going to sue you. I'm going to sue you. I'm going to sue you. What?
She practices law. We did see that Melanie was out for a jog when the letter about Gus came in, and I just jotted down that. I don't think that we've seen her running since that deleted scene of Michael getting blown in that scary park to get back at Dr. David Cameron.
In that cemetery?
Yeah, she came trotting up in like full-on sweats and running clothes. So it was nice to see a nice exterior shot. Yeah. And one other thing I noticed about this scene was they used to live across the street from a park. That park is gone now. The house looks the same, but there's no park across the street now.
They must have lost the house then.
They watched the shooting location.
Yes, that's what happened.
I noticed like so many weird things in this one, like Debbie's yearbook, Melanie and Lindsay apparently moving, Justin being a cutter and scarring up his calf. I'm like picking up on all these like little small elements here. And I think it's because I didn't like this episode at all. So I started to,
you started to nitpick at it. Yeah.
Yeah. So when the lesbians just appear at Brian's loft while Justin was being spanked, Justin's fully dressed. I think this scene would have worked better if Justin was just in his briefs the whole time. Just well, kind of like the elephant in the room.
He just did it because, yeah, because
he was being spanked. He had his pants down and they just walk right in. Just leave him there.
Excuse me, I am in the middle of my punishment.
Brian would never have put his clothes on when they came over.
We know this.
Yeah, he just wanders around in whatever he happened to be on.
Which is nothing, usually.
When Brian accompanied Lindsay to the preschool, Lindsay had these strange lines where she's talking about how she once envisioned doing this for him in real life with Brian.
In fact, there was even a time when we first met that I thought this could have been the reality.
What the fuck?
Okay, I'm glad you bring this up because was she talking about specifically with Brian or is she talking just saying I could have envisioned this with a man?
I took it to be the two of them.
Well, because see, I didn't know if there was any of that kind of history given to us. We know that they've been friends for a very long time, but that there was ever any type of what could be construed as romantic things. Because I feel like since the dawn of time, Brian Kenny has been a latent homosexual with no interest in the vagina.
Not even latent. Blatant.
Blatant, yes. So I that's why I took it to mean that she could have envisioned this with a man. Could you have ever seen yourself with a woman, Brian?
Lindsay said something in another episode where they were talking about college and Lindsay made a vague reference to them actually having done it before.
But I thought we knew that Brian has never actually had sex with a woman. I thought we knew this.
I don't know that. Why do you know that?
Now I'm questioning everything. This is good.
Yeah. I thought it was weird that Melanie would just so willingly capitulate to Brian as the stunt double father.
Well,
she should have marched right in there and practiced law on those preschools.
Well, when they burst in to ask him and she says he's going to say no right away because he does that every time with us. And I would be like, this is the one point where I was literally like, calm down, Mel. He gave you a fucking wedding. Cool it.
Well, kind of. He didn't do much work on it. George Shickle supervised. Did more work.
He rallied the troops to make it happen.
Yeah, he pointed at everybody and said, here's your job. And then he put his ice mask on and went to bed.
Exactly. That is why he is Ad Man of the Year.
Mr. and Mrs. Kinney, there was this call to Melanie and Lizzie, and Gus got rejected. This made me wonder about something is, do we know Gus's last name? Is it Peterson, Marcus, or Kinney? We don't know.
I feel like it would be a hyphen of Mel and Lindsay's. I don't know if they would bring Kenny into the situation.
Yeah, this was like yet another weird thing that I picked up on.
Well, and I actually kind of enjoyed the Henry, gift of the Magi irony of the situation and that they got rejected because they were denied. Gus was denied in favor of a child with same-sex parents and they laugh it off and realize, of course, this is how it would go. I liked that, and it sort of reinvigorated that Lindsay need not deny the homosexual part of herself for Gus.
What a tired episode this was.
Oh, okay. You know what? We should just wrap it up and get to our recap so you can relieve yourself of all this tension.
Timeliness. I gave this one a 3. That's my default average rating. There wasn't anything all that timely or timeless about this episode, so it just sort of didn't matter whether it was timeliness or not, so my default go-to is 3. It didn't hurt. It didn't help. There it was.
I will say after discussing this episode, I'm lowering my original rankings just a little.
I convinced you again.
A little bit. With the timeliness, I'm going to say a 4. And I will tell you, my big thing is I understand Justin's position when it comes to paying for school, because Lord knows I'm still 6.5 years away from paying off my student loans. So I know what it's like to incur those kinds of debts and what it means to be a student in today's world. I think the whole obsession with getting Gus into the right school is such an odd obsession that is going on today about trying to make sure that our children are getting quality education, and that obsession behind it, which I think also leads to an unfair amount of pressure on the child themselves, led me to give it a higher ranking than you.
So for information accuracy, I gave it a 1. Only because I think identity theft, perpetrated by Debbie, is both easier and harder these days. Debbie seems to have pulled this off with no problem in 1972, all the way up to 2002, when this was airing. So that's not accurate. You can't get away with that for that long.
We're dealing with an era where there wasn't the kind of technological advancement. So she could have easily have found a name, changed her name, left it at that, because everything, this isn't the digital age. So I feel like there's a better way to hide the paperwork, as it were.
It was the digital age, but it wasn't quite
to
the...
I'm talking about like the 70s when she did this, you know what I mean? So
she should have been caught by then, though.
Well.
What'd you give it for information accuracy, Matt?
I'm going to give it a 3. Because I didn't find anything too terribly wrong with it. I took the information, as we just discussed, kind of at face value. I wasn't harmed by anything in this moment.
Yeah. For relatability, I gave it a 2. The Michael's father story was ridiculous. I just can't think of any better way to say it. I think they realized it was ridiculous too after they shot it, because it's never mentioned again, only in passing. So this was kind of a throwaway story. Melanie and Lindsay trying to fake their way into a preschool, I thought was kind of ridiculous too. I just don't think you have to do that these days. Justin becoming a go-go boy was really all that held my attention in this episode. I thought that storyline was in keeping with the queer as folk that heretofore had not jumped the shark. That is something that we probably could have seen in season 1 and liked, because it was much more edgy. In season 2, midway through, it was something to cling to and think, whew, at least there's something I can latch on to here. So
I did 3. I guess this episode did not offend me as much as it offended you. I said I went through the ride. I'm glad that they brought some amount of closure for knowing who Michael's father is. I think Justin trying to make it on his own in this world I'm still dealing with. You know, I realize that that's sort of, I wasn't at the point where I was going to be, you know, being a go-go dancer, but you know, I was finding my way as a young adult. So I feel like I'm still there. So I found myself relating to that. And I wasn't harmed by this episode.
So that's our verdict on episode 13. It's because I'm gay, right?
Next week, Justin is rolling in money, but his schoolwork suffers. Carl asks Debbie out, and George asks Emmett to accompany him on a world tour. Oh, I know what's coming.
That's episode 14 of season 2, and it's called The Dangers of Sex and Drugs. We are still queer as folk. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us, and subscribe. It really means a lot to us, and it does help more people find the show.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Matt Dominguez.
And I'm Patrick Randall. We'll see you next week. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez.
New episodes every Wednesday as we take apart the show one episode at a time.
Available now on iTunes,
Google Play,
Stitcher,
TuneIn,
Overcast,
Pocket Cast, and all your other favorite podcatchers.
Still, Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.